there's certainly something really special about wearing your country's kit, seeing all the other athletes in their country's uniform, and doing it against the best on like the day that's classified the World Championships.
That was Rory Linkletter, and this is episode 153 of the Inspire Souls podcast. Hi, I'm Carolyn, and I'm a roadrunner.
And I'm Kim, and I'm a trail runner. Welcome to our podcast, where we bring the communities of trail and road running together and explore the parallels between running and life.
Today, we're excited to finally have Rory Linkletter on the show. Rory is a professional Canadian athlete who lives and trains in Flagstaff, Arizona, is sponsored by Puma, and is coached by U.S. half marathon record holder Ryan Hall. At the World Championships Marathon on August 27th in Budapest, Hungary, Rory was the top Canadian, placing 19th in a season's best time of 2:12:16. Unfortunately, given the hot and humid conditions, it was not a day for chasing personal best times. Out of a field of 94 men, Rory had the 65th fastest personal best of 2:10:24 on paper. But he didn't let that intimidate him or prevent him from competing as well as he possibly could. He ran by feel, patiently and methodically picking people off throughout each of the four 10K loops until he was passing some of his own running heroes. Kim and I were on the edge of our seats as Rory walked us through his preparation, the details of the race, and perhaps most importantly, what he did to celebrate afterwards. Rory is such a great storyteller and such a fun athlete to cheer for. He's as hardworking as they come, but also has a very full life with a wife and two young kids at home, one of whom is a newborn. You'll have to stay tuned until the very end to hear about Rory's trail running aspirations, but let's just say they made Kim very happy. So without further delay, please enjoy our conversation with Rory Linkletter. Okay, everybody, today on the podcast, we have one of Canada's top men's marathoners, Rory Linkletter. Welcome to the show, Rory.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we are so excited, Kim and I both. And let me first open with a formal apology, actually, for not having you on the show earlier. So a little bit of context on this. You may not remember, but you and I met very briefly back in May of 2022 when we rode the elevator down to the lobby. I rode the elevator with my friend Jen, and you and Ben Flanagan got on the elevator, and it was the day of the 10K champs in Ottawa. So not this year, but last year. And as a little bit of a side note to the story, my friend Jen and I still like to think that we were your good luck charms because Ben and you placed, I believe, first and second in the 10K that evening. So congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, where were you this year? I didn't have as good of a finish.
You weren't there this year, were you?
I did run it. I just was in bad shape. I was coming off injury.
What?
So I came seventh this year, but I was expecting that just because where I was at. But I love Ottawa. It's a great, it's an amazing race.
I was there. I ran it again this year. So I was like, you know, way back. You wouldn't have seen me this year, that's for sure. Last year I watched and then I ran the half marathon the next day. But this year I ran the 10K and it was another scorcher.
I ran the 10K and then paced the marathon the next day. So right. I had a double duty.
Oh boy. Holy. But since then, we've actually had Ben on the show, not one time, but two times. And this is where my apology comes in. So this is obviously way overdue, but I kind of think it's also perfect timing in many ways because you've gone on to represent Canada not once, but twice on the world stage since that day we met last May. And we're going to have so much to talk about this evening with you. So you have just come back from, actually, speaking of Ben Flanagan, we actually just had him on in very recently in episode 151, where we discussed all the ins and outs on how to make the Canadian World Championship team. So why don't we start there? How did you find yourself on the World Championship team for Canada that just took place at the end of August in Budapest, Hungary?
Yeah, so this year was a little different than last year. As you mentioned, this was the second year in a row where I represented Canada at the World Championships. Mm-hmm. This year, I kind of knew I was going to get selected because of where I was ranked throughout the mm-hmm. process. Based on last year World Championship, I did quite well. And
yes.
So I knew my standing was pretty strong and it was likely that I was going to be selected again. So I was able to kind of plan for it this year. Mm-hmm. Last year, on the other hand, I had no idea I was going to be selected until 45 days before the race. And I was not training for a marathon at all. I was training, actually, the day I found out I was going to go, I was looking at flights to Dublin, Ireland to try to break four for the first time in the mile at the Morton.
No way.
Wow. Okay.
Talk mile to marathon. Woo.
Yeah.
Luckily, I like to think of myself as someone who operates really well off of speed first and then transitioning to the strength. So that worked really well for me. It's not like I wasn't in good shape. I was racing. I was feeling really good. I just wasn't marathon specific until 45 days out, which was a new thing for me, but it was fun.
Yeah. Well, I almost think in some ways, depending on the person, I guess, but that lack of pressure, right? Like if you have 45 days notice, then there's almost that like built-in excuse if you don't do a well, I only had 45 days to prepare. Like, does that factor in for you or where you're like, well, the pressure is kind of off a little bit?
I would say I did have this perspective of like, I'm going here for the experience, whatever happens, happens. It's a world championship. This is going to be really cool. I was especially excited because it was in Eugene. Mm-hmm. Eugene is a place special to me because of the memories I formed while I was a collegiate athlete in the NCAA. So I was really pumped to race a world championship in Eugene. So I did go in with very little like kind of stress and weight, but I also wanted to do my best and see what I could do. I knew I was, by the time I got to the start line, I knew I was in good shape. I just didn't know, you know, what that meant yet. Mm-hmm. So it ended up going quite well. And that was a really cool way to kind of teach myself as a athlete and someone who coaches other athletes that sometimes it doesn't have to look traditional or perfect, or there's not one way to prepare for a marathon, but many ways you can go at it. And I learned that, and now that's something I think I will carry for the rest of my career.
Well, do you want to tell everybody how you did last year? Because again, on 45 days notice to run a marathon, you placed top for Canada, I believe. But what was your overall placing and time?
I wish I was top for Canada last year. That would be Cam Levins, who was fourth last year.
Of course. Yeah.
I was,
what should I forget?
He was fourth in a Canadian record. And right. I was second Canadian, 20th overall, and a personal best by over 2.5 minutes at the time.
Awesome.
2:10:24, which was a huge breakthrough for me. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun. It was a really great experience for me, and it kind of opened my eyes to, oh my gosh, like I think I can be good at the marathon. Because up to that point, I had wanted to be a marathoner. I knew I could be a good marathoner, but it was a theory. I had never seen it come to fruition. So that was a really big validating moment for me and in my marathon career.
Yeah. Yeah. So you talk about that being a breakthrough, and I think I've seen you write in other places that like it took you a while to figure out the marathon. And I think many, many a recreational runner can raise their hands to that one. Like I feel like I've never really run a great marathon, an okay one, but it's taken many times. Do you want to talk us through kind of your marathon career a little bit? And how many times did it take you to, how many marathons did you run before you had that big breakthrough?
Yeah, I can give you a quick snapshot of what it looked like. So I ran in 2019, the Toronto Waterfront Marathon as my debut. And that was strictly because I was fresh out of college. It was going into an Olympic year. And I thought, hey, I don't think I can make an Olympic team as of now in the 5,000 or 10,000. Let's try our hand at the marathon. I've always been intrigued by the marathon. And so I jumped right in. And right out of college, I ran a 2:16 debut marathon at Toronto. I ran a race that, looking back, was probably not that smart. I ran alone in the first half because I thought I wanted to pace it a certain way. And there was two pace groups, one in front of me, one behind me. And I sat myself right in the middle of them. And that was a huge mistake. I positive split by a bunch. I went through half marathon in like 66:20. And ran 70 minutes the second half, which felt horrible at the time. Like, you know, you're just slowing down. And then my second one was a little bit better. I went out faster and slowed a little less, but I still totally positive split at the marathon project, where I ran 2:12:50, I think, at the time, something like that. And then I went and did my first major, Boston, the next year. Mm-hmm. Went horribly. Absolutely. Like as bad as a nightmare day could be. I walked three times. I was getting passed by everybody. I wanted to stop so many times. It was miserable. And that was a huge lesson. The next one.
And can I ask a question on Boston? Yep. Like when you wanted to stop so many times, you were walking, like what kept you going?
I literally was about to walk into the medical tent when Parker Stinson, a friend of mine, an American runner, ran by me and said, dude, it's Boston. You got to finish. And then I told myself, well, the fastest way back to the hotel is actually to just keep running because our hotel is at the finish line. I survived to the finish line. And that was really, really traumatic. And so I was so mad because I felt like I was in decent shape for that one. That 8 weeks later, I did CIM and I ran CIM and got second and ran a small, small personal best and my first ever negative split in a marathon. So I went 2:12:50 for second overall. I ran with my good friend, Nick Hauger, on his debut marathon. He got third. It was an amazingly fun experience. Mm-hmm. I was racing the whole time, negative splitting, and it was so positive. I was like, that was amazing.
Again, another quick question on that one. Yep. Like CIM, they say, like I've run both Boston and CIM as well, and they're similar course profiles. Like obviously Boston is a bit more dramatic, but rolling hills, right? For CIM in the first half and then it flattens out. Do you think you did better at CIM because you had maybe run Boston first and learned, or do you think it was just a way easier course?
I mean, I do think it's an easier course, but I think more importantly was the like vengefulness I was running with and the strategy I went in with. Like we ran a very conservative race plan. Like my Boston approach was I'm trying to get top 10 at a major. Like, and I was kind of hyped up for that. And like when the race fell apart on me, there was both the physical battles of the day and the mental battles of the day. And CIM was a completely different environment for me as a pro athlete. CIM is pretty low key. Mm-hmm. It is a big race, but I was just kind of there to kind of run a good marathon. That was literally what I said. I said, I don't care if it's 2:14, 2:13, 2:12, top five, top 10, top three. I just want to run a good marathon. And I let my competitive juices come out at the end, but really the first 20 miles, I just ran it as conservatively as possible. And, left that with a positive experience after kind of struggling the start of my marathon career. So that was marathon number four. And then number five was Eugene. And we just talked about that. That was a great experience. And then I did Toronto last fall. That one was the first marathon I ever got to the start line and was just grateful to be on the start line because of a rough build where I was kind of in and out of some injuries. So that was the first experience of like showing up to the start line, feeling a little banged up, but grateful to be there. Mm-hmm. Race went okay. I ran 2:13, went for it at 30K with a battle with Trevor, and kind of just gave it everything I had until I couldn't. And then I settled in and just survived to the finish line. Mm-hmm. And then the seventh marathon of my career was this most recent one, Budapest.
Okay.
That's a good rundown. Thank you.
Yeah. Did you hear that, everyone? It can take seven marathons to figure it out.
There were small victories along the way, but I would say the seventh one was the most beautifully executed and joyous experience. The best I've ever felt, too, like during. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's pull on that a little bit. You talked about CIM being, you know, a marathon that you felt like you had done well. And then this last one, again, it was a great experience. You did it well. You've alluded to some of the factors that play into that, but what by your definition equates to feeling good and like you've done it well?
Yeah, I would say where your preparation meets the execution. So like knowing what shape you're in, knowing what the field looks like, making tough decisions out there and being patient and also tough in the late stages. But I think the most important thing is just being like matching your fitness. So I know that in previous marathons, I felt like I was super prepared. And then like, I was like, I don't know what happened out there. Like the marathon just got me. And that kind of gives me the perspective of going into everyone that could happen. And it kind of takes a little weight off like, hey, it's a marathon. Anything can happen. But I think I'm starting to get more confidence in the fact that it can go really well after, you know, I've done seven and I would say three were like really solid. Two were okay. And then two were not so great. One being horrible, Boston. Right. And I think that's a pretty fair batting average for the marathon. I'd like to continue to slide in some really solid ones so that I can get a little bit more consistent. Cause I do know that it's possible to be good every time out. You don't have, you can't be great. You can't have your best day every time out, but I think I can tighten that window. And that's just, you know, knowing your body and knowing how to gauge efforts early in the race, knowing how training works and knowing when to pull the strings and when not to. I think that's just a veteran thing. Like just, I felt like I was the most ready for this marathon and the most aware of what to feel and how to feel it and how to mentally stay in it.
Well, that's exactly what I'm hearing from you. It's experience and awareness. So you say matching my fitness. Well, the only way you can match your fitness is to know your fitness. And you only know that over years and years of experience to know where you are in relation to your current self, your past self, your future self. So that's really interesting to me. Yeah. Thanks for highlighting that. Yeah.
Well, and it's kind of the perfect segue into my very first question about World Champs, which is you came in with, on paper, the 65th fastest personal best. Out of a field of 94, your personal best of 2:10.24 was 65th. There was a whole bunch of guys, like 34 men under 208 and 25 men under 207, 18 men under 206, like fast, fast guys. And yet you finished 19th place. What do you attribute that to?
Being smart and taking really calculated risks throughout the race would be the easiest answer. Like a lot of the people I beat were going for broke and I could have tried that strategy and maybe it would have worked out better. Maybe it would have been catastrophic, you know, but we knew the conditions in Budapest being warmer lent to a lot of people having rough days and just the nature of championship racing. People show up excited. They want to contend. They want to medal. They have this, you know, goal that they trained in mind with all segment. And I had those too. I wanted, my number one thing was do better than last year. I wanted to check that box, but I also had given myself this like dangling carrot of like, maybe you can be top eight. Maybe you can be top 10. Maybe you can even be top five, you know, like I was letting myself daydream about the perfect day, you know, everything falls right, you know, and I attribute my success on the day to just like accepting the situation as it was. Cause I was a little upset when I saw how warm it was going to be, because I was like, I know I'm ready for a PB. I know I'm ready to run the best marathon of my life. So I didn't want the elements to prevent me from being able to showcase that. That was my biggest fear, is that something would happen that would prevent me from just showing what I had done to get to that start line. Because if you just train perfectly and then run a mediocre race or a bad race because of conditions, it's like it feels like a waste. You know it isn't deep down, but you want the external validation of the result.
Yeah, definitely. So walk us through those conditions. Like it was the very last day of World Championship, so August 27th, I think. And that's typically how the men's marathon is, typically on the last day of the Olympics, the last day of the World Championships. Isn't that right?
They mix it up, but yeah, it can be. I think it all just depends on the year. They throw it in all sorts of ways. I feel like they should have a set schedule, but they never do. Okay. I think I was in day four or day five last year in Eugene. So they always do men and women back to back, and they just alternate who goes first. So we were after the ladies this time. We were before them in Eugene. But yeah, the climate was just warm and humid. I think it was 22 degrees Celsius, 72 Fahrenheit at the start with 75% humidity, 68 or 69 dew point. It's just like the start actually didn't feel horrible because we were in the shade a lot, but it wasn't cool. Like if you jogged, you started sweating immediately, right? Mm-hmm. Like standing there, you're comfortable. We did a lot of cooling techniques that helped with that. But anyways, it was warm and it got warmer throughout because guess what? The sun was coming up and the temperature was rising. And by the second half of the race, which is why a lot of carnage happened, it rose 7-8 degrees and the shade dissipated from the course. So it got more difficult as the race went on, conditions wise, as well as just the nature of running a marathon getting harder. Definitely. As you go on.
And it was a looped course, wasn't it? Like it was a 4 10K loops plus a little bit or something like
that. Yeah, we did a 2K, we did a 2.2K loop to start, and then we did 4 10K loops to finish.
Okay. Okay. Beautiful course, by the way, because again, amazing. I was watching on TV. But like, how do you feel about those looped courses? Are you like, oh my gosh, I have three more of these like after the first one? Or do you like the kind of knowing what's coming up?
I wish every marathon was a looped course. That is my biggest takeaway, is that it is such a great mental way to break down the race. I imagine if you've done a certain marathon enough times, this could start to come into fruition for you on a course that isn't a loop. Say you've run Boston 6 or 7 times, you probably know like the back of your hand. But to me, the thing about running these loop courses is as you go throughout the race, it almost is like the loops go by faster because you've been here before and you kind of learn the course as you go. And I can break it down mentally into fourths because it's 4 loops. Eugene was 3 loops. It was it's just such a bite-sized piece to be like, just get through this loop, you know, or like taking the focus of each loop. So first loop, don't do anything crazy. Just stay relaxed. Second loop, all right, kind of just get into your rhythm, kind of lock in. Third loop, you can start being aggressive if you feel good. Fourth loop, survive and also be on the attack, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of how mine played out. It was like the first 2 loops were kind of chill and chill. Third loop, I was hunting as hard as I could and was already getting a lot of people. And then the fourth loop, I started to feel the effects of the marathon and was like, okay, still eyes forward, trying to catch people, but at the same time, make sure you don't do anything that blows up your legs here.
Right. And were you successful in that last loop of catching a few people? Like I was watching the TV coverage of what was happening at the front, and unfortunately they weren't showing you, but like when they showed the finish line and I saw you come in, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's Rory. And you were first Canadian this year. Isn't that right?
Yes. 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 So I think I was in like 60th after one loop, 45th or 50th after two, and then like 30th after three. And then I passed another 10 or 11 people on the last loop. So I think I passed about 10 people per loop on
That's
average.
That's satisfying. That's
yeah,
great.
It was. And the last loop was obviously like the biggest, like you could see them like one at a time coming back. And the people I was catching were higher profile athletes at this point. Like I think I remember at one point passing a Moroccan athlete. I can't say his name to save my life because I can't pronounce it. But I know he was second at New York last year or the year prior. And I was like, dude, this guy's been second at the New York City Marathon. Like that would be the best day of my life. And I'm just passing him. He's a 206 marathoner, right?
Yeah.
And there was other times in the race like that where I was catching or passing somebody that I was like, this guy, I know who this guy is. This guy is good.
You get starstruck.
Yeah. Well, starstruck. More like I get an ego bump. Like I'm like, oh yeah, I'm beating this guy today. Like it's a good feeling to get, we call them scalps. That's what my college coach used to call them. And for the longest time, I actually thought that term was scallops. I was saying scallops, which are not, that's seafood. That's not what it's called when you beat somebody. So
right.
So I have a question. As you pass these people, like, did you feel like you had enough in the tank, like it was a confident pass, or were you just hanging on and hoping you could stay ahead of them as you passed each one?
Yeah, so the nature of me catching them was usually I was going a lot faster than them. So it was, there was only 2 people, maybe 3, and it was all on the last loop that when I passed them, I wasn't flying by them.
Okay.
Like, so like I would pass them and it was like within 2 seconds, I was 10 meters ahead of them. Cause it was like, it was like they were standing still. Those people probably finished 2 minutes behind me. A lot of them, 2-3 minutes behind because of the way that I was running. Cause I was running still even splits or pretty close to it. And they were slowing down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So, until the last loop, there was a couple athletes. I remember specifically a pair of Spaniards that I passed that latched onto me, and one even tried to pass me back like a K later. And I was like, look, like I've been running alone for a while, so I welcome this. Like, please, like take some help. Yeah, I was very excited about that. I was like, okay, this will keep me engaged. It'll keep me here. But then we hit like the bridge, and then there's the downhill, and then you go up through a tunnel. And I think on the combination of the bridge and the tunnel, I put probably another 20-30 seconds on him. So that was short lived. It was like 25K to 26K. He like kind of battled with me for a second, or maybe it was 35 to 36, one of those two.
Oh, that must give you so much energy to still be. I mean, obviously you're working hard, but you've managed your energy in such a way that you're running within yourself and able to compete for those spots at the end. Like, it just must feel so, so good.
Yeah, it was really solid. I mean, I attribute a lot of that to Athletics Canada having like really, really smart people that help with preparing you for the heat. So there, and my coach, obviously, like I prepared for it all summer with training. And then also once we got the forecast, Athletics Canada has exercise physiologists on staff, and they can give you a chart that shows you how much this weather is supposed to slow you down. And if you can actually like honestly reflect, like what shape do I think I'm in relatively, and what sensation should I feel early in a marathon, you can kind of hedge your bets somewhere. And I pretty much just tried to hedge my bets better than other people and was successful mm-hmm. doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you talking about Trent Stellingworth here? Is he the
he was one of them. He was one of them. I don't want to get his last name wrong. I think it's Ollie Armstrong. I should look this up at some point. Ollie. We called him Ollie. Okay. He's a British guy that works with Athletics Canada. He gave me a little bit of a heads up. And then Trent Stellingworth, because he was there for Natasha Wodak. Mm-hmm. We did have a sit down as well. And then I kind of, what I did is I took all the information those guys gave me. And then I said, Ryan, what do you think about this? And he says, sounds about right. And then I kind of, Ryan didn't say run this pace, you know, no matter what, yes. or Trent didn't say you should run this pace and no faster. I kind of looked at it, gave myself a window, and then said, like, kind of just feel it out there, kind of like see what the groups are doing, kind of find something. And I had a good vibe with that.
Mm-hmm. And now, did you do anything else in terms of like pre-cooling strategies or anything, ice vests and all of that? I know that they've employed that, or they were using that at the Tokyo Olympics.
Yep. I did a lot of that stuff. So first and foremost, this starts early in the summer. I was wearing every easy run, long tights, long sleeve black shirt. So long sleeve black tights, long sleeve black shirt all summer long here in Flagstaff. And we had a pretty warm summer. So every easy run was heat training. And then once we got to Barcelona, it was really hot and humid. So the last week of training was pretty hot and humid. Then we went to Budapest, which it was hot and humid. So I felt pretty acclimatized to it. And then pre-cooling, I did, you know, I didn't wear a jersey. I just bare skin vest, and then like kind of get a towel, soak it around, wring it around your neck, kind of just keep yourself as cool as possible. And then in the race, I had these chemical gel packs attached to each of my bottles that you break them, and it's kind of like a hand warmer, but for cold. And I would, it works quite well. I did it in Eugene as well. And I do it in training to practice it. They're not very big, and it's just the Palmer cooling method. You know, you just hold something cold, and it works yeah. really, really well for your whole core temperature. Mm-hmm. And then the occasional sponge on the course, you know, squeeze it over your neck and head and rub your arms and legs, just kind of get cool air, cool flow. And I think mm-hmm. I did all those things as well as you could and felt like I managed. I didn't think about the heat during the race. Now, when I got those cold sponges, I was like, oh, this is really relieving. But when I didn't have that, I wasn't like, oh, I'm so hot. But it was just one of those things where it's like, you didn't notice you were hot until you felt the relief of something.
Right. Do you feel like you're typically pretty good in the heat?
I've had bad and good experiences. So it's hard to say. I've had some experiences that I was like, oh, I must be good in the heat. And then I've had some where I just get absolutely devastated by the heat. And I think it's just a matter of preparation, and sometimes the body just shuts down in the heat. I don't know what to say. Like, sometimes it's just a factor. So
yeah,
you can prepare, and sometimes it just takes you as a victim.
Absolutely. Now, you've talked a little bit about your coach, Ryan Hall. Maybe for those who aren't as familiar and maybe nerdy in the running world as we are, can you explain to us who Ryan Hall is and maybe a couple of other things that he did differently to prepare you this time than the things you've already talked about, like the cooling strategies and whatnot?
Yeah, so Ryan Hall is the fastest American ever over the marathon, not the American record holder, just to be clear, because he did it at Boston, so it doesn't count as an American record. But he ran 204.58 at Boston, and he is still the current American record holder in the half marathon from the Houston half, where he ran 59 minutes and 44 seconds. And Ryan was a huge inspiration to me as an athlete, because I'd heard all these like almost like folklore, like these stories of who Ryan Hall was, how he trained, how he lived. And he was this hardcore, you know, committed athlete. And I don't know, like he was kind of like a hero to me. And then I moved to Flagstaff. I see him around town and now he's this big buff dude riding a bike in front of his wife all the time. And I didn't know anything. I hadn't really interacted with him since moving to Flagstaff other than like the wave as he goes by and I go the other way. But when I left Northern Arizona Elite, the team that I joined when I first moved to Flagstaff, Ryan was at the top of my list desired coaches because I wanted someone in Flagstaff, someone in person, someone who could work with me. And because I'm kind of needy, I kind of want someone there for me. And he said yes. He said he would work with me. And we kind of, you know, hit it off from the beginning. It was a match made in heaven. He fits really well for me personality wise. He always knows the right thing to say. He challenges me in ways, but I think he also understands me and caters to what I like and when what he thinks I'll enjoy too. So it's kind of just this symbiotic relationship where we're working really well together. And as far as this marathon, the preparation went as smoothly as possible. And we kind of give and take, push and pull, talked about things that we thought we needed. And we were always on the same page. It was super cool. I remember calling him 5 weeks before Worlds. And I was like, man, I feel so ready. I feel so good in these workouts. And we were just discussing what to do the rest of the block. And I was like, I really think I just need like this workout and this workout. He's like, oh my gosh, I was going to say that. Like basically the exact same thing. Like yeah. We were just like taking the words out of each other's mouths. And it was like, that's when you know you and your coach are kind of like think of the sport in the same way. It's like literally I let him write all my training. I don't tell him like I want to do this workout, but he often asks for my feedback. And then we often see eye to eye. Like I'll tell him I would love to do a long tempo. And he's like, oh, I already had that on the schedule here. You know what I mean? It's just, he catered really well to my personality and my weaknesses and my strengths this build. And I think it came together really well.
So I'm curious, Rory, was Ryan with you in Budapest?
Ryan came to Budapest, luckily, not because of me either. This is the cool thing. He was coaching another male in the marathon, a Jordanian athlete named Mo, who Ryan has coached for longer than he's coached me. And Mo wanted Ryan there. And Jordan didn't have like staffing and like a lot of people there. So like Ryan basically got to be Mo's on the course, like bottle hander and everything. Wow. And me and Mo were far enough apart that Ryan could kind of focus on me and then get Mo and then focus on me and then get Mo. So I got to see him the day before the race. He like got in like that morning, the day before, and we did a shakeout jog together. And then he was there race morning and then he shipped back to Flagstaff. So,
serendipity.
It was nice.
Yeah. Now this might be a bit of an unfair question, but it sounds like everything really went amazing in your preparation and you were fit and you were ready for something special. If it were a cooler day, more ideal temperatures, what do you think you could have done time-wise on that course in perfect weather?
Yeah. if you look at both the men's and the women's race, people were running anywhere between like the numbers actually say people ran 5% off personal best performance. And that is different based on what your personal best is. Like 5% of a 208 marathon and 5% of a 224 marathon are two different things. Mm-hmm. But for me, based on this, what the physiologist showed, it was probably between 2 minutes and 30 seconds and 4 minutes. Now that's a huge window, but that's also like, there's variable here. You can't just pinpoint it and just say, oh yeah, you got 4 minutes faster based on conditions alone. So I know I was in personal best shape on that course. I know I would have run under 2:10:24, especially with the way I executed. I like to think I was in close to Olympic standard shape as well. And as that being, that was kind of one of the things I was eyeing. If it was like, if we got lucky, you know, if we got a cold front, but I think that was within the realm of possibility. And Ryan believes that I can do that as well. So, and I don't think he's not the kind of guy to just tell you something if he doesn't believe it. So yeah, I think 208 to 210 was kind of the general window of like what that day produced. And I can't pinpoint it much more than that, but I know I was there.
Well, that's why I said it's an unfair question, like totally unfair question to ask, but it would almost seem, from my vantage point, I'm like, that would have been a sub 210 day if it was a nicer day, you know, and that would have been probably so validating to actually have like that amazing training cycle produce that, you know, amazing time as well. But like 2:12:16 in that heat and running such a beautifully executed race is something absolutely to be so proud of. And we were losing our minds cheering for you over here in Winnipeg. So thank you and congratulations. Thank you for giving us something to cheer for where you make us very proud.
Yeah, I left that race confident, you know, that like,
excellent.
I would have loved the time, but I left it knowing like, hey, we got better, learned how to do something out there, and I can take that to the next one.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So what did you learn at this World Championships about yourself, or what do you take away? What were some of your biggest learnings from this race?
One, control what you can control, which is the most common, like every sports psychologist in the world, that's like number one thing that they can tell you. I wanted to change the weather with my brain going into like the week of when I saw the forecast as it was falling into place. But I kind of threw that aside, started accepting this new race plan. And then I got in that mode and then I said to myself, well, I can't control what the rest of the field's going to do. I can't control this or that, but, and I felt like I just had a really strong hold on the piece of like, whatever happens today, I'm going to do what I can do. And if it means top 20, if it means 210, if it means 212, if it means this, I'm just good with it because I'm just going to do what I can do. Number two for me was have fun. I'm one of those guys that likes to be kind of competitive, but in like a, like almost like a, I'm playing a game out there. I don't know if you saw this photo by Everything You Got. It was, I knew the photographer. He's from Vancouver. He's Brianna Scott's husband, actually. Mm-hmm. And I saw him on the course, saw he was taking pictures. I stuck my tongue out at him. You know, every time I saw Ryan, I would talk to him. And, you know, I was the first 20K, I was with a group and I was talking to them. I was kind of just like, we're going to do great, man. Like, I was just like feeding off that energy. Wow. You know, a couple times I heard, you know, Canadians cheering for me, and I would, you know, tell the crowd, like, let's get, like, I was feeding into it. I was enjoying the World Championships. You know, I was trying to have fun in that atmosphere and take advantage of it. And I think that I am one of those people that really, really feeds off joy and the love of it. Like, I just love running. I love everything about it. And I feel like when I've underperformed, it's been when I've tried to be the serious guy in the race and like try to be like what I think I should be rather than who I am. Mm-hmm. And so I just had fun. And last but not least, running a marathon by like feel and pace and just kind of knowing what your body's supposed to feel like is a really fun experience. So like, I think I'll always search for that line of competing and pacing and listening to your body and kind of find that balance, because I do want to be able to just say, go for it. Yeah. And at some point I want to be fit enough to just go with that front group and not even think twice.
Right.
But that's a process. You know, Des Linden is someone who's shown that process can lead to eventual major wins and Olympic teams and top five finishes. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you got to always kind of know your body first and foremost.
Yes. You can never get away from that fact that we have to know our bodies. You're making me want, I'm running Toronto Waterfront in 6 weeks, and you're making me want to do it without a watch in a way, because I am so good at pacing. And sometimes, like, I don't need the watch to tell me how I'm feeling, right? And sometimes it can actually interfere with how you're feeling. If you're like, yeah, but, you know, my watch is saying I'm 3 seconds off and like too slow or whatever, so I should speed up. It's like, no, but this is how I'm feeling, you know, and that just might be the way I am feeling this day. Like, it's, I don't know. So I might just put tape over it or something. Like, I really want to do it with no watch.
Yeah, Ryan has made me do many tempo runs where he takes my watch, because I have to put it on Strava, because if it's not on Strava, it didn't happen.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
But he'll wear it and I won't, and he'll ride the bike in front of me.
Okay.
And it's been fun. We've done this a couple times, and he'll ask me after, what pace do you think you ran? And I'm never even close. I have no idea. But I know I'm running the right sensation, but I'm always off by like 5 seconds, which is a good thing. I think, because usually I'm faster than I think I am. Like, so I think that's like a good lesson to be like, sometimes these numbers are kind of like, they're a handcuff. They're kind of holding us back in some ways. And that's not always the case. Sometimes they're good for us. They're good balance. Yeah. But I think in Budapest, I didn't care what the watch said. I ran some splits that were fast. I ran some splits that were slow. And I just kind of knew that I used it as more of a safety net and a governor than I did like any sort of like goal. Like I didn't really necessarily get tied too much to it. Mm-hmm.
So putting a bow on this World Championships thing, what does putting the Team Canada kit on mean to you? Is this the second time you had the marathon in Eugene last year and then this year in Budapest? Has there been any other times, like maybe on the track, that I'm missing?
I've done Pan American Games on the track. Mm-hmm. I did the 10,000 in 2019 in Lima, Peru. And then I've done 3 World Cross Country Championships, but those are smaller. Those are what we call B-level teams. I don't know, you know, that's just what Athletics Canada actually calls them. But okay. I love it. You know, like the first time I earned the kit, it was like the best day of my life. At the time I was 18, it was a World Junior Cross Country qualification. And I came third at the National Championships in Vancouver at Jericho Beach. And it was kind of my welcome to Canadian running moment, because my whole running career up until that point was based in the US. I went to high school in the US. I went to college in the US. So I had never really entered the Canadian running world until that day. And it was a really special thing for me. And it's something that I have a really hard time ever imagining myself not wanting to continue to do it. Like, mm-hmm. I know a lot of my American friends will turn down world spots because, you know, financial opportunities or whatnot, you know, that the inner workings of professional running. But to me, Eugene was such an opportunity, and I finished that race and I was like, that was so much fun. I want to do that again. And Budapest was even more fun. So it's like, this is the pinnacle of the sport. It's the tip of the spear. It's, you know, I've run Boston and I will do, I'm sure, all the majors at some point, or at least most of them. And I have a hard time imagining that they're better than the World Championships in like the sense of atmosphere. I know that they are great and they're different, and Boston was incredible, even though I didn't have a great day. And I want to do New York so bad. I want to do London one day, Tokyo, you know, I want to do them all. But there's certainly something really special about wearing your country's kit, seeing all the other athletes in their country's uniform, and doing it against the best on like the day that's classified the World Championships.
So what do you do to celebrate at the end of a race like that?
I'm a big post-marathon beers after. I mean, you don't drink at all during a marathon build. I mean, I do a little bit because I don't have any hard, fast rules, but I don't mind really letting loose immediately after. Like, I mean, that's the first thing I'm trying to do. Me and Justin Kent, fellow Canadian, went straight to the hotel bar and ordered 2 really big beers and drank them together and had fun. And I went on to have a few drinks with Ben Flanagan at lunch that day. And yeah, I mean, like, that's kind of my tradition. And I had some teammates at NAZ Elite that kind of showed me the ropes in that way, like kind of like post-race marathon parties. And they're fun. I mean, like, you worked so hard to be there.
Absolutely.
And there's this, all this pressure that builds in this. It just feels so nice to just be like, that's over. Let's let loose. And sometimes I look more forward to the after race than the actual race.
But, okay, you're human.
Yeah, there you go.
Certainly. I mean, I loved the race while I was in it. But part of me, the week of, I was like, man, I can't wait to just like hang out and just chill and let this, like, there's almost like this, I'll be relieved when it's over feeling. And, you know, when I finished, I was relieved to be finished with the marathon. But now I'm like, oh man, I wish I was running a marathon next week again.
Right. So. Well, let's talk about that. What is on the horizon? I know we have in about a year, just under a year's time, we have the Olympics happening in Paris. Are you going to be vying for a spot on that team?
I hope so. That's the hope. It's a hard team to make with the current Olympic standards and the depth in Canadian running. I have confidence that if I do my very best in the coming months, that I have a very good chance. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that exact plan and road to Paris looks like yet. I know I'm going to run a marathon in the early spring, late winter timeframe. something fast, probably overseas, just because those are where the best fast opportunities are. But I don't know.
Can you announce that or no?
I don't even know yet. So I wish I could. If I knew, I would share. But there's a couple options, and my agent is at work trying to nail it down. That's kind of the not so fun part of the professional running world is that you actually have to go through all these avenues. I can't just like sign up online, which I know it's not that easy for you guys either. You got to do lotteries and all the qualifications. Mm-hmm. And I coach a lot of sub elite marathoners, and they have all sorts of troubles sometimes. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they'll ask me, "Do you think you can get me into London? Like, do you have any?" I'm like, "No, I can't get you into London." Sometimes I can't even get myself into London sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, you've alluded to this already. The standard for making the Paris team is 208.10. Now, if I recall, the Tokyo standard was 209.30, or was it 211.30?
211.30. And the Rio standard was 216.
Whoa.
Do you, okay, when we talked to Ben about how to make these teams, he was saying at least for the 5,000 and 10,000 that there's a standard, but you don't have to hit it. You could get in through your rankings. Is it the same with the marathon, or do you actually have to also hit the standard?
It's the same with the marathon, but I honestly don't think anyone will get in without the standard. And the reason why I say that is because they have a goal field size at the Olympics, and it's 80. It's 80 people. And I think as of right now, there's already 55 or 60 people that would have qualified by standard. And that's only accounting for 3 of each country, right? Mm-hmm. So we have, I think, 7 months till the window closes, end of May or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot of time for 20 more people that haven't already hit the standard from a country that doesn't already have 3, because there's all these caveats, right, to do right. it. And I don't know who those people are, what countries might, I haven't done the deep dive in, like, because we know Japan already has 3, Kenya already has 3, Ethiopia already has 3, Eritrea already has 3. You know, you can start to cross off a lot of the top athletes in the world by doing that. But I can't, in my brain, I can't rely on, oh, I'm going to get in off ranking, or I'm going to get in off points. I have to live like the standard is the way. And I think if I do that and I prepare well, I go to a fast race and I run for the standard. If I fall short and I run, say I run 208.30, 208.45, which would be great. I would be stoked with something like that. Then I have to just kind of look at the rankings at that point. But I have to kind of live under the assumption that it's standard or bust. I can't try to game the ranking system. I just don't think that's a very smart thing to do. I think the safest bet is to knock out the standard. Because if you make it by standard, 85, 90 people can make it by standard. They're going to cut it off at 80 if there's ranking, if it comes down to ranking. It'll just be a clean line at 80. But if you hit the standard and you're top 3 in your country, they'll just keep letting you in.
It's so stressful, though, just as we've just alluded to, like you can do everything right in your preparation and then get a crap day where it's just not conducive to running fast. And you're at the mercy of that weather, right? Like so much is out of your control, I guess, is what I'm saying. So you just have to hedge your bets in terms of like, I go to a London or somewhere that's notoriously like you can count on being decently good weather, flat course. Is that sort of how you're approaching it?
Yeah, you're basically taking the odds, right? So you look at past results and you talk to people that have run it and you get feedback and you kind of talk to the race director, like, hey, are you going to have a pacer? Are you going to have a group? Are you going to have this or that? Right. And you kind of have to do all that, game the system that way, and then see what happens. So
Ben was saying you can't leave it to the last minute, I imagine. Like you're going to want to give yourself a few chances to hit this standard over the next 8 months.
Yeah, and in the marathon, you really don't have a lot of chances. Yeah. So I'm telling myself I have one chance, but I'm going to save a backup second chance. Like I'm going to plan a backup second chance, but I'm telling myself that first chance is my last chance, if that makes sense. And quite honestly, I don't think emotionally I want to get up for it multiple times because it is, it's stressful. I mean, this is my livelihood. This is my profession. This is my family. This is my dreams. Yeah. There's more, it's more than just something cool that I can get a Olympic rings tattoo on my arm or something, right? Like this is how I provide for my family. I've got two kids. I've got a lot of things on the line here. So to make an Olympic team would be huge for me and my family. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely very important, but I think I have to kind of protect my mental health and just say, let it go and just try, give it your best and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, let's go there for a minute. You know, you talked about your family being a large motivator for you to do well and achieve excellence. I guess there's two ways we could go there. I want to know what motivates you, but also tell us a little bit more about you and your family life.
Yeah. So I'll start with my family life and then we'll get into what motivates me. I'll just say my wife and I got married in 2018. We met as freshmen in college, so first year of university. She was a gymnast at BYU. I was a runner on the track and cross country team. We started dating pretty much right away, and 4 years later we got married and we started our family with our son Jace in 2021. Sorry, I almost forgot what year he was born. He's only two. he turned two in July, and then we welcomed our daughter McLean into our family in June this summer. So she's 3 months old as of yesterday. This is September 4th for when we're recording.
Wow.
Okay. But I mean, it's been a crazy change in my life from I was already kind of felt like the old guy in my friend group. Cause you know, kids my age, I say that deliberately, aren't having kids yet. They aren't married yet. So I'm a couple stages of life ahead of a lot of my peers. But I would say I am very happy with where I'm at, and it's a pretty fulfilling path I've chosen and I've found myself in. But it's been a whirlwind. But I've felt like it's helped me a lot in my running and in my life. I just feel the pressure is good.
Can you expand on that? Like some people are like, I need to live like a monk and just like eat, sleep, and breathe running. And then other people are like, when I have a lot of other things going on, it helps me, you know, to not be so one dimensional. So are you saying that having the balance of like, you know, your family and other things to do is helpful for you?
I would say so. I would say so. Mm-hmm. I'd say I'm naturally inclined to overdo things and to put too much in one basket and to let something be super all consuming. And so having the forced distractions and forced attention away is really beneficial for me. Cause if I was, say, a bachelor with no kids and no responsibilities, I would probably be a lunatic of a runner. just knowing that like my personality would just fixate on it, you know? So I think it's a really good thing for me. It's probably not for everybody. There are certainly times where I look at my life and I go, it would be a lot easier to just be like finishing my long run, going home and just like watching having Netflix or having a nap. And sometimes I can do that, but sometimes I just can't. Sometimes I've got to chase a toddler around, or what if he wants to play with me? Am I going to be like, sorry, I had a long run this morning. Like I'm not doing it. I'm get lost kid. You know, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. So it's just different. I it's not worse than the alternative. It's just different. I find it to be really, really uplifting for me.
Mm-hmm. Uplifting. I love that word. So let's move now into your primary motivators. What keeps you striving at this point?
I would say first and foremost, the desire to be great at something. Ever since I was a little kid, I thought I would be a professional athlete. When I was really little, I thought I was going to be a hockey player. When I grew up a little bit and was in the US, I thought I'd be a basketball player or a baseball player. And when I got to high school, I realized I wasn't going to be any of those things. And I started running cross country for fun because I had a friend doing it. And then I got good as high school went on and realized, hey, I could maybe get a scholarship and go to a big school for this. And then when I got to the big school and I got better and I made, you know, I just kept climbing this ladder and wanting to be better and better and better. And then it became, oh, maybe I can go pro. And then the logical thing after as a pro is make the Olympic team, you know, the pinnacle of our sport. So I just think striving for greatness, I think, motivates me more than anything.
Awesome. Okay, Rory, you are also the former Canadian record holder in the half marathon. And I just have to marvel at like how many times this half marathon record has changed hands in the last little over a year. So you set it in Houston in January of 2022.
Yeah.
1 hour, 1 minute, and 8 seconds, everybody. That is a blazing fast half marathon. And I believe Ben Flanagan was in the race the day you set that, wasn't he?
Yep. Yep. It went there because, funny enough, I was interviewing Ben Flanagan on my podcast at the time. And okay. He had mentioned that he was going to go for it. And I remember taking that note in my brain. And I wasn't training for that at the time. But I was like, I'm not letting Ben go for the Canadian record that I've been striving for since I debuted in my half marathon. Yes. I'm going for it when he goes for it. So I circled it. I was like, I'm going there. And then on that weekend, there was kind of like this, you know, Ben and I are really good friends, but there was kind of this assumption that he was going to break it and I was going to be second to him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that really made me angry. So,
Healthy, competitive way.
not at Ben, obviously. Like Ben's the nicest guy. It's just kind of like this, there was just this, maybe I was making it up in my head because I could do this. I'm definitely capable of this. But I felt like there was this feeling like, oh, people just pencil Ben in as the record holder. So I just shadowed Ben through the race and felt good at 15K, passed him. And I ended up having a great day breaking the record. And then he went on to break it in Valencia. And then Cam in Vancouver on the seawall in pouring rain by himself.
I know. Hats off to Cam Levins and all of you. But I guess my question with all of that, and it's very fun as spectators, by the way, we love seeing these records change hands. But can you comment a little bit on the depth of Canadian men's marathoning at the moment and what it's like to be front and center in that group of people?
I don't feel front and center. I think it's Cam's world and we're all just living in it. Out of respect for what he's done, what he's accomplished in the last year and a half would be my career goals. You know, he's run 205, he's run 60 minutes, he's run 207, and been fourth at a world championship. He was top five at Tokyo. All in those accomplishments all together, and it seems like he's still building steam, and this is someone that many people had written off as being done in his career, and here he is in this new chapter being as good as ever in a lot of ways better than ever.
Is he a few years older than you? 4 or 5 years?
I think six, if I'm not mistaken, because I never overlapped with him in the NCAA. Mm-hmm. I think he finished maybe even seven. I'm pretty young. I'm 27. I think he's 34. So okay. I would have to double check that, but I know he's quite a few years older than me. And Cam's the stud. He's the leader of the men, if we want to give a title of that. And then I think there's a group of 3, 4, 5 of us that are kind of chasing his shadow and striving for his level of excellence. And I think it's been really good for Canadian running. So just to throw a few names out there, I won't leave anyone off, but Tristan Woodfine, you know, has run 210. Ben Prisner's run 210. I've run 210. Trevor Hofbauer's run 209. And then we got guys like Ben that haven't run the marathon yet that I think could be great. And hopefully he sticks with the track for a little bit longer. He's doing great there. Just stay there, Ben.
Yeah.
The pool doesn't
need to be any deeper.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's Justin Kent, a guy that was on that world championship team that's a super talented individual that's run a couple of really solid marathons. And you know, you can't count anyone out. This is the kind of sport that, you know, underdogs often achieve great things. So there's a great group of Canadian marathoners. And I think we all get along pretty well and like each other and root for each other and support each other. I remember in the spring, it felt like we were all cursed except for Cam. Ben Prisner was supposed to run Tokyo. I was supposed to run London. And Trevor Hofbauer was supposed to run Prague, and none of us started our races. And we all kind of encouraged each other from afar, messaging each other, checking in with each other, and just like, you know, felt bad for each other, honestly, because we all know what we're all striving for. And none of us is rooting for the other one to stub their toe and not start the race, you know?
Right.
It's a good situation right now.
That sounds super stimulating, super fun, super motivating. You know, back to one of your prime motivators, it sounds like there's such an incredible vibe and competitive feel in men's, you know, road racing and running right now. So I'm curious, at some point, I have to ask, as the trail runner on this podcast, do you think you'll ever venture into the trail running arena at some point in your career?
Yes, I'm glad you asked, because this is something that I wish more people knew about me, but it's kind of like a secret that only the hardcore Rory fans and like day ones would know, is that I love trail running.
Okay.
And my start in running was a high school cross country runner in Utah, which, if you know anything about Utah, it's a trail running mecca. So for cross country practice, I used to just run up mountains as a cross country team. That was like what we did. We literally just ran up to peaks, and then we called those our cross country workouts many times. And I carried that through college. I ran for cross country training in the summer. I would run up to the top of mountains just once a week. We call peak a week with a couple of my teammates. And I love that. I just love being in the mountains. It's the only time I run and I don't look at my watch and wonder how much longer I have to run. It's literally the only time. You find me on a trail in the mountains, it's the only time I feel like time is irrelevant and I'm just moving. So I hope that I accomplish everything that makes me feel full in this sport, in the road running world, in the Olympic realm. And then I aspire to one day be at a Western States or a UTMB, chasing down guys like Jim Walmsley and Tom Evans, right?
Tom Evans, absolutely.
That's one of my favorites, is Tom Evans. So personally, I was just trying to think of the guys that I really like admire and look up to. And yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say I would automatically be on that level, because obviously they've put in years of work and are very talented at that. And there's a lot of unknowns for me, but I know I love the mountains. I know I'm pretty good at climbing up them, and I know that I have a desire, and I consider myself a highly motivated individual. And one day I hope to channel that motivation into a different world.
Well, that's exciting. My first 100-miler was actually at Zion, along the mesas there in Utah. And I can definitely see why you were hooked after running a little bit in that area. You know, I've often said that really, honestly, the only criteria to finish 100 miles is you have to actually want to.
Yep.
Now, how fast you do it is up for debate, but to actually finish, you have to just want to. And I can hear that in your voice, that, you know, there's a lot more to be seen from Rory Linkletter in many different genres of running. So that's super exciting.
Mm-hmm. Love the sport. Love it. Love, love, love trail running. So I look forward to that day when it's time.
When it's time. Yeah.
You just became like the most qualified person for our podcast by admitting that you want to go to the trails. You achieved at such a high level on the roads. And Kim, I think you were saying we had Reed Coolset on. And so when he kind of finished up his competitive marathoning career, he's moved to the trails as well. So we'll be very excited to follow along with that transition. But Rory, it's been super fun getting to know you a little bit better. And we will be watching your career very closely, wishing you all the luck and cheering you on from Canada as you work hard for Paris and everything you've got between now and then. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. And I look forward to following this show now as a guest, maybe a recurring guest, since Ben Flanagan's been on twice. I hope to be invited back.
You're not competitive.